Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/achieve today.
Greetings, I'm Nate Langson, and this text message was sent on the 9th of February 2015. Now, I'm currently overseas, I'm afraid, huddled in a New York hotel room betwixt pillow and quilt, in what I suppose is essentially a posh grown-up's fort, albeit one erected solely to contain my head to do a podcast. It's quite delightful, actually, much as I hope the resulting sound quality is within your head. I've always been a stickler for audio quality, actually. In a way, I think portable audio is more intimate than anything one might amuse themselves with in a bedroom. I mean, I'm basically penetrating your head with my voice. But my fleeting American residence has not prevented me from producing something for the extremely flattering numbers of you that have already subscribed to my show. The UK this week enjoyed some compelling news in that BT has offered to buy mobile network EE for close to £13 billion. Now, to put that in context, that's nearly £4 billion more than David Cameron spent in 2012 to host the world's biggest advertising festival in London, the Olympic Games. Three's parent company, Hutchison Whampoa, also put in a bid for over £10 billion to buy O2 last week, and it got me thinking about how the consolidation of these British telecom firms and media providers might affect our choice as consumers and businesses in the coming years. So, this week, while I'm here in New York, I got in touch with someone who I thought would be able to help shed some light on how these acquisitions might play out for us in 2015 and beyond. Well, joining me now, Alison Sheridan from Nosillacast. How are you doing, Alison?
I'm doing great, Nate. So happy you have me on the show. This is going to be fun.
Yeah, this is only four episodes in, and I've already suggested reversing the format of the show from when I was on your show a few months ago, where we talked about, I think it was our view, or rather the UK view of American tech.
Yeah.
And this time we're doing sort of an American view on UK and European tech.
Yeah, this should be fun.
We've picked up the table, wiped it clean, rotated it, and then got it messy again. Well, this is good. So a slight bit of background for why we wanted to talk about this. We have, in the UK, had a number of interesting mergers in the telecoms market. We've had O2 getting picked up by Hutchison Whampoa, which is the parent company of the Three Network. We've also had EE being bought for £12.5 billion, or rather, it's been agreed to be bought by BT for £12.5 billion. And this is all in the bid to become either a quad play service on BT's part or to just simply get a lot more customers and a much better and wider network. And the reason that I thought this would be interesting to talk to you about, Alison, is because you are an American. Am I right?
Yes, and I will be representing all of America.
Yes.
Well, the United States, not Canada.
I looked through everybody in my address book and I said, well, I could ask Obama, but he's busy ruling the world. And I thought, you know what? I bet Alison's got a view on the telecoms market. But no, more seriously, though, the reason is because in the US, there is a wider coverage, or rather, there's a lot more land to cover and fewer mobile networks and cable cable carriers.
Providers.
Yes, thank you. Providers. And it's caused some controversy in the past just because it's limited consumer choice. It's caused a lot of arguments in some regions where maybe only one cable provider is available or only one network is able to give decent coverage. And so I thought I'd wanted to get your view on how you think that's affected sort of the American telecoms and cable landscape, if you like, which sounds much more boring when I put it like that than it actually is, and what you think potentially these mergers and these this sort of consolidation of network companies could mean for the UK.
Well, I heard a guy from Korea who at All Things D one year who talked about how easy it was for them to get this incredible broadband they have there And the point he made was that they had a very small country that was also very tall. So you can take a giant building and wire it up real easily. And he said, you know, look at you guys. I mean, you got Montana. I mean, Montana by itself, you know, there's 8 people in the entire state and they're spread really far apart. How do you possibly tackle that? So the problems that we have, like you say, because of the great amount of size, really makes this a tricky problem. So first of all, you've got, I want to say I heard this week it was only 80% of the country could even get any kind of broadband. And so right away, you've got people who are completely disenfranchised on that to start with. So if you think about that and then look at the areas that have been, call it wired out, the investment that those companies have put into those areas, I'm not surprised we're in the situation we are, where we've got these monopolistic behaviors going on where people have put in the work for it and the money to lay in the network. And then everybody's saying, well, yeah, but now I want choice. How you do that? I guess I would certainly be nervous about the consolidation you've had. But when these mergers you talked about are done, how many choices would a typical person, say, in London have?
Well, in London, we would actually still have quite a few. I mean, we would have, let's just say, as you say, all these mergers go through. We would have 3 major networks. So we would have O2 and 3 together. We would have EE under the rule of BT. Now, BT doesn't currently have its own mobile network.
So it's an MVNO?
It's just not a network at all. BT doesn't currently run any sort of wireless network. It runs the landlines in the country. So it would effectively take on O2 as its network. And EE is the biggest network in the country. So you would have EE, and then you would have Vodafone, which is the other one. So you would have those areas well covered. Outside of the UK, outside of London, you would pretty much have the same choices. The difference is that the attraction for, say, BT with EE is being able to offer a cable service, which EE has, as well as its 4G service, as well as the landline service that BT has, because it owns and licenses out all the copper lines that go across the country everywhere. And it also has its own TV service. So it would be the first to offer quad play. Now, that's great if you do live in these cities, but there are so many places in the UK where you can't get cable and you can't get 4G. So they're going to miss out on those. But you would still generally have a choice of 3.
But that is interesting. That I remember when you first said that EE was getting the first 4G network in England when you announced that on your other show, and that to me was fascinating. That with our almost complete lack of competition in the United States, 4G has been here for a long time on a lot of networks. And so you would think in a competitive arena that it would accelerate innovation and getting these higher technologies in. What do you think held that back?
Well, that's a really good question, but the answer is remarkably simple. It's simply because EE was a company that was set up to be a parent for T-Mobile and Orange, both of which were previously separate networks, and they merged. And they simply had a part of the wireless spectrum that could support 4G, whereas all the other networks had to wait to get their 4G spectrum when the analog TV signals were turned off.
Okay.
It was quite simply a case of the company already had the spectrum that they could use, and the others had to wait for Ofcom, the regulator, to allow them to switch on their 4G network. So they had about a year's head start, and that was kind of the only reason that they were able to do that so early. And it was seen by some as a really uncompetitive move and was unfair. But at the end of the day, they weren't abusing their monopoly by doing that. They just had a head start, and that was totally fair.
So the thing that makes me queasiest, would give me the worst feeling in the pit of my stomach of everything you said, is when you said that BT is going to be providing actual content as well. And I think that's where we've gotten really nervous, and the recent announcement by Chairman Wheeler, the head of the FCC, that he's going to be changing the rules for the providers, is that when you've got someone who's providing content and they're providing you the pipe, Now that is a complete and utter conflict of interest. It's the definition of a conflict of interest. So your inclination is going to be to say, hey, I'm going to deliver this to you real fast, but this other guy's data, it's going to come down slower. Or you can pay me to make yours go faster. You know, that's the death road right there. That's the scariest road, I think.
Yeah. Now, this is the net neutrality debate, which was the other thing that that I wanted to touch on. So you've done a fantastic job of doing my segue for me.
So I just segued that for you?
such a professional, honestly, such a professional. But yes.
You need to see it happen.
This is the net neutrality debate. Now, at the moment, we in the UK are fairly net neutral in that currently Virgin, for example. So Virgin is the main supplier of cable in the UK, and Sky is its main competitor. And Sky is actually providing its service over digital satellite. So they're sort of apples and oranges, but they are massive rivals, as an apple and an orange is in a supermarket, I suppose. no one tends to eat the same one at the same time. And Virgin, though, and this is where it gets interesting and slightly complicated, Virgin already has a mobile network because it has Virgin Mobile, which is an MVNO. I forget who it piggybacks. I think it might be EE. But yes, I think it is EE. And so they're offering their 4G service as well. Now, currently, they're not penalizing anybody on their cable service how should I put it? They're not prioritizing their own content over cable. So
dare they? I mean, is there an FCC type organization in the UK that would be watching that and ready to slap them?
Yeah, Ofcom. Okay. And Ofcom is, and not just Ofcom. I mean, it's basically a parliament itself. Ofcom is sort of there to mediate, but there's a council of ministers for Europe that will govern the EU at large in terms of how net neutrality is enforced or indeed not enforced. But this came up a lot last year, actually, where effectively net neutrality was being adopted as law in Europe, which means that Virgin Media would never be able to prioritize its own services over Virgin Mobile or its cable service. And similarly, and to go back to your point, BT would not be able to prioritize its own television service over a rival like Netflix, which it tends to be the common example.
Sure.
But I did want to ask you, though, because in the US, you've seen this from the other angle. You have seen these sorts of things abused because there has been some debate in the past. And I think that Netflix does pay one of the cable providers for a faster lane to consumers' homes. Is that right?
Well, it's not exactly right. And this is where it gets into a real weird area. There's these things called peering agreements that have to do with how much data is flowing from one network into another network. So let's say I own a network and you own a network, and I'm going to give you, 20 petabytes a second of data, but you're only sending 10 petabytes of data towards me, then we need to make an agreement that I'm going to pay you extra. If it was even, we wouldn't pay each other anything. And that's how it kind of got started, I think. And then now you start getting into, they call them, it's called edge something, where these things bang up against each other. And that's where Netflix has to work with Comcast, and they have to work with Time Warner, and they have to work with Verizon Fios to make sure that they've got adequate servers locally to absorb the amount of data that comes in. It's really complicated. It's a lot more complicated than just you're paying to go faster or slower. They are definitely not doing that. If they had done that, that's one of the problems with the net neutrality debate is technically, I don't believe anybody has actually completely violated any of these rules that we want to see in place. And that's sort of where the big companies or the ISPs are saying, well, we haven't misbehaved. You don't need to put all these rules on us. So it's sort of a weird technicality. The peering arrangement is not the same thing as paying for a fast lane. It's something slightly different and really complicated.
And hopefully not something that's going to be an issue for people in the UK when these networks start merging and these sorts of debates rise. I mean, to put into context for anybody who's sort of unfamiliar with how much a demand is being placed on some of these networks, if you take a service like Netflix or the BBC iPlayer, at any peak time, so generally primetime television time in the evening, these two services alone might be using a third of all internet traffic across UK networks. So that means that even when you look at BitTorrent and everything else that's going over the networks, they're still not accounting for any more than two-thirds of the total usage. Netflix and BBC iPlayer are using about a third. Now, that is an astonishing amount of traffic. If you think that if you took the iPlayer and Netflix offline in an evening, the networks like TalkTalk and Virgin Media and all of these things, they would have a third more, potentially up to a third greater capacity available to other consumers. So in a way, if I put a businessman's hat on, and hey, I'm not sexist, a business person's hat on.
There you go. You could hear me thinking that, couldn't you?
I could just hear many people thinking it. It was a chorus in the back of my head. But exactly. But I just thinking, well, if I put that hat on, I can sort of think, well, you know, why should they be upgrading that network so much faster just to accommodate these two services that don't pay them anything? You know, I can understand that argument, as flawed as I think it is, because they're creating a demand for their customers to give the ISPs more money because they want better service to use these services. I can at least see where the argument from the ISP standpoint would come from. But and you say that there haven't been any, pardon me, any flat out abuses of net neutrality in the US, and certainly I'd like to think that is definitely the case. But it does mean that it's something to watch out for, possibly.
Yeah, we don't trust them at all.
No.
By the way, I just checked the stats on that. Netflix by itself accounts for 35% of internet traffic in the UK.
Wow.
Without adding anything else to it. I think the other two-thirds is spam, right?
Yeah, it could well be, or pornography.
Right.
But I think that, I think maybe the figures I looked at were a little old. I mean, certainly when I looked at it, it was at least a third. But by the sounds of it, if you factor in the iPlayer as well, which, unlike Netflix, allows you to queue up and download HD content as much as you want. You know, you could, I mean, I did this only 2 days ago before flying out to New York, which is where I am at the moment. I queued up the most recent three or four episodes of Top Gear. You know, they're almost a gigabyte each, you know, and about four or five other programs as well. It was probably about 4 gigabytes of TV that I just tapped. I just went tap, and they all start downloading onto my iPad. So that's,
I'm so jealous of iPlayer.
It is fantastic. And now you can do that for the last month's worth of TV, not just the last seven days. So, you know, if there's a program that's on every single day, like a soap, so EastEnders is a really popular sort of soap opera drama type thing that's on in England pretty much every day, or certainly several times a week. You know, that's all on there in HD. If you miss an entire month, you just go through and just tap 30 times and you've got HD versions of that downloading to your iPad, to whatever device you want, PS4, PS3, Xbox, Mac, anything. They're all on there and they're all in HD, depending
on the... So there's no digital rights management nonsense going on there?
There is, but it's not something you run into. It's extremely liberal. So, you know, the only thing you can't do is copy those files somewhere and keep them forever. They will expire eventually, but huge amounts of content on iPlayer, and this is true of radio as well, they're actually on there indefinitely, depending on what it is. And anytime they're repeated on TV, then they appear on iPlayer again. So you get loads
of... But that makes no sense, Nate. Then you're not going to have piracy.
I know. Isn't it bizarre? Isn't it bizarre? But, I mean, the BBC is something of an enigma globally, I think, because it's publicly funded and they have to offer the service back to the license payer. It's illegal not to pay for the BBC services if you have a TV. So they have that benefit. They don't have to rely on... There's no advertising. There's no product placement. There's no anything. It's just you're paying through the law programs to be created. And so in return, they're making it as accessible as they possibly can to as many people as have funded them. So it's great, but that does...
So jealous.
And I think people are right to be jealous, because it's one of the only things I think the UK does when it comes to something like video on demand, where we can genuinely say that it's ahead of everywhere else, because there's nothing else really like this anywhere in the world that is legal and is completely free of any form of advertising in any of its forms. So I
think that since you get all of the cool NASA stuff that we do for free, that we should get this stuff for free from you guys.
I absolutely
trade you.
I absolutely agree. But well, to be honest, as a separate note, I mean, there is a huge reason to let the iPlayer exist with a monthly subscription to other parts of the world, or at least parts of the world where a business model like that could be sustained. I mean, do you think that if the iPlayer opened itself up to the US and said, well, instead of it being free, it's, you know, $10 a month or whatever the equivalent would be in the US for something like that, do you think people mm-hmm. would pay for it?
I definitely would think so. I mean, now I'm sitting and waiting for things like Bletchley Circle and Sherlock and all those things to come to us. I think Sherlock was from the BBC, right?
Yeah.
So many things that we watch. What's the new one? I just started watching The Fall. I think that's you guys too. But I have to sit here and wait for it to come over here. So those are three things right off the top of my head that I would pay for.
Yeah. It's a real shame that it's not there, because they're missing out a lot of money. The reason is because the BBC, it's the BBC that makes the programs can't charge for them. But the BBC Worldwide, which is a for-profit part of the BBC, can. And so that's the arm that puts them on iTunes and sells them on Blu-ray and puts them on Netflix eventually and things like that. It's two different arms. You know, one only serves the license fee payer, and one serves the rest of the world.
Well, here's a perfect example about how twisted up all this stuff is. When the Olympics were on, I wanted to see the women's gymnastics. In order to see it, I had to use a VPN to go into BBC in order to see the U.S. women's gymnastics team, because it didn't come on here.
You see, this is the problem with the sort of the regionalization or the region locking of content. I mean, these are decades old business models that are being supported, and they have to move very, very slowly. And it's always a shame that piracy can move so quickly to support new technologies and viewing habits, but it's just not possible for these businesses to do what people want as quickly as they want it, because it really does take time. And I think that, you know, it's a shame that something that is so obviously going to be immediately successful as an iPlayer with a $10 a month subscription charge for the US, like the amount of money that could bring back into the BBC to fund more content. I mean, mm-hmm. it feels almost like a crime to the UK that isn't a possibility, and that we're making content that is of interest to so many people around the world, and yet we're not allowing them any way to give us any money for it. Like, that's a huge shame when you read stories about cuts being made at the BBC. You just think, just let someone else pay for it, for crying out loud.
Here's the spigot right here. Turn it. You know, there's a more positive way to look at this, though, is maybe that technology is moving so fast that it's pulling these older concepts forward slowly, but pulling it, that, you know, if it weren't for the internet, I wouldn't be sitting in my home in California talking to a guy from England. I mean, I know you technically are in New York, but let's pretend that's not true. I consider you a friend of mine now, and we've never met in real life. And these kinds of things are happening so quickly that it'd be impossible for these things to move as quickly as we want them to. But we're pulling them forward because now we have friends all over the world who are telling us about cool shows that are going on in other parts of the world, and now we want them. So now that pull is happening.
It's very true. And I think the great thing about podcasting is that it's a kind of medium that is allowing that barrier, that Berlin Wall, to be pulled down. Because, you know, I mean, yep. I sort of think about it a little bit how at the moment with 4K, some of the best way to get 4K content is to make it yourself, because you can shoot it on many high-end phones now. And yet there's still no really good way of getting 4K into the home. And maybe the answer to the iPlayer debate, for example, is go and make your own. It's a podcast. It doesn't care about region locking.
Yeah, yeah, that's true.
Mm. Well, Alison, it has been a complete pleasure to talk to you, particularly since I'm in the same country as you at the moment. Narsilicast is where people can hear more of your thoughts. Do you want to give people a reminder of how you tune into you and what sort of stuff you cover on Narsila?
Yes, the Narsilicast is a, my tagline is a technology geek podcast with an ever so slight Macintosh bias. In other words, kind of a huge Macintosh bias, but we talk about security stuff. We talk about gadgets and a lot of Mac and iOS applications. The show has come out every Sunday night for coming up on 10 years now. So I'm past 500 shows. And so I think I'm into it for the long haul. You can find it over at podfeet.com. And you can follow me on Twitter at podfeet.
And you should do, because that is how people like Alison and I meet. Although it may have also been through Tom Merritt, who is a mutual friend of ours, I think, who introduced us originally.
Yes, we'll have to throw him a bone.
We should throw Tom a bone on DTNS. Great. Alison, thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks a lot.
Until next week, I'm Nate Langson. Check natelangson.com/podcast for information about the show, show notes and links, and of course, subscription links for iTunes, podcast catchers, and RSS feeds. See you next week.
My business used to be weighed down by the complexities of in-person payments. Then, Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe came along and changed everything. With Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe, I streamlined my payment process effortlessly. Now I can accept in-person, contactless payments right from my iPhone. No extra hardware required. What's truly remarkable is how I can cater to all of my customers' payment preferences, whether they're using cards, Apple Pay, or other digital wallets. Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe ensure a smooth checkout experience every time. And it's not just me. Stripe helps businesses of all sizes, from local markets to global retailers, scale quickly and stay agile. To learn how Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe can help grow your revenue and reach, visit stripe.com/tapiphone.